On this episode of Skeptico,
I'm starting to think in terms of our relationship to time as kind of this circuit. We're like completing these circuits, moving through life, orienting towards future rewards. And this, I think, explains a lot. I had a series of blog posts about a year ago now where I took on Carl Jung's concept of synchronicity using this model. And I think it really explains so-called meaningful coincidences much better than synchronicity.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris. And since the beginning, the mantra of this show has been follow the data wherever it leads. And I have to say, as mantras go, that's been a pretty good one, at least for me. Now, sure, I've had to endure, and you've heard me eat plenty of healthy helpings of humble pie as I've done it about face on my cherished beliefs. But I've come to appreciate that that's part of the process as well, so I can get over that. But as you know, by following the show, sometimes following the data isn't enough. And I think today's episode is a good example of that. Because what Dr. Eric Wergo has done in this paper that he's published in Edge Science magazine and in his various writings is given us a new way to look at the data that's been staring us in the face all along. And that is the data about precognition and what that might mean for these experiences that have been widely reported for a long time, like synchronicity, that is that strange confluence of events that just seem to fall into place in an unexplainable way. And what he's also proposing would fit with a lot of deja vu experiences. It might even fit with remote viewing and a variety of psychic experiences. The link he's drawing is between the well-established research we have on precognition and presentiment and these other widely reported phenomena. It's an interesting link. As usual, I don't agree with everything that Dr. Wergo is offering up, but he sure gave me a lot to think about. Maybe I should start warming up some of that humble pie. So I hope you enjoy this interview with Dr. Eric Wergo. A couple of things before we get started. One, I have to again thank a skeptical listener for pointing me towards Dr. Wergo and his work. I will leave his name out since he goes by a pseudonym on the forum. But nonetheless, he's one of a bunch of people that have been guiding me and pointing me, directing me towards guests. I've done more and more of these guest suggestions, and they turn out great, so I thank you for that. And secondly, and sadly, I have to say goodbye to my old mic and soundboard, and unfortunately, you are going to hear the poor quality of the last gasp of a dying microphone and soundboard. I didn't realize it had caused as much trouble until I listened to it, so the audio quality on my end isn't as good as I would like, but I still hope you can work your way through this very interesting interview with Dr. Eric Wergo. Today we welcome Eric Wergo to Skeptico. Dr. Eric Wergo is a science writer with a PhD in anthropology and a professional background in archaeology, psychology, neuroscience research, and a ton of other stuff that we're really interested in on this show. He's got a fantastic blog at thenightshirt.com, and he's recently published an excellent article titled Trauma Displaced in Time, in the very excellent Edge Science magazine from the folks at the Journal of Scientific Exploration. Eric, welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Alex. Great being here.
Let's start with a little bit more about yourself so people know about you and the nightshirt, the shrouded nightshirt where we enter into that dream world where all things are possible. Tell us what you're thinking.
Well, the name, the nightshirt, comes from a dream I had, you know, many years ago, just very vivid dream. And I actually have a little snippet from the dream sort of at the top of my blog there. Just, there's nothing, no real significance to it necessarily, but, yeah, I guess where I'm coming from is I'm all about the dream world and what, you know, all the possibilities of the dream world. And,
But you really expand that out in some different ways, because when people talk about the dream world, you know, we just did a big show on a guy who does lucid dreaming and then has expanded that into all sorts of travels to extended consciousness. You kind of step back and have this kind of anthropological kind of bent to you, which is awesome. So you're covering psi, parapsychology, UFOs, precognition, synchronicity, psychoanalysis, and you're just kind of touching on all those things. What is your... what are the origins of your kind of sensibility or your approach to looking at that extended realm?
Yeah, I see myself as kind of a liminal figure, and not in the sense of really far out, but in the sense of someone sort of between two worlds, in the sense that I sort of come from a science background. My parents were psychologists. I have a scientific education. I work in the sciences. I'm very much, you know, I'm all about science, but I guess middle age, I sort of became, very interested or re-interested in, you know, these fringe topics that I thought was really cool when I was a kid. And then I got back into them as an adult, and I really take them seriously. And I guess I see myself as kind of a spokesperson for these subjects like psi and UFOs and related subject matter, you know, trying to address an educated, scientific-minded audience and say, hey, look, pay attention to these things. These are things worth taking seriously. They are not, you know, they are not worthy of ridicule. They are, you know, really super important subjects. And so I sort of see myself as kind of addressing a, you know, the kind of audience that might, you know, read just plain old science blogs and science writing, you know, say, hey, look at this other stuff. This is not what you think it is. It's pretty important.
But, you know, the other thing I really like about what you do, Eric, is you take a stand, which I think is so necessary, you know, because it can, I think, sometimes when people try and take that position, sound a little bit condescending or, you know, just kind of regurgitating other stuff and, you know, oh, I've figured this out kind of stuff. And you really seem to be taking a stand and taking it a step further, like what you did in this paper that I just alluded to. And I want to talk about that a little bit, because I don't know that I necessarily agree with you on all of it, but I think it's really awesome for someone to say, hey, what if we look at this thing a little bit differently? Let me share with folks a little excerpt from that I think will tee up maybe an interesting conversation. You write, so at the risk of sounding like a reductive materialist bad guy, and then he says parenthetically, which honestly I'm not, I do think the answer to psi, not necessarily consciousness, is going to be found in neuroscience. What did you mean by that? Well, you do sound like a bad guy there.
There's nothing wrong with neuroscience, Alex. I'm sort of taking a stand on my blog, and this is based on the last few years I've spent really delving into the psi literature and the research. I feel like a lot of people both in the field and peripheral to the field who are writing about this subject are kind of, I don't want to say stuck, but they're working with older metaphors that may be kind of misleading. And of course the big metaphor is sort of the idea, the sort of telepathy metaphor, the idea that thoughts somehow travel through space and you know, either, well, of course that's basically disproved a long time ago, by researchers. And yet it has held on as kind of the main mental model we use in thinking about this. And I want to suggest that this is not about thoughts through space, and it's not even about non-locality, whatever we mean by non-locality, this idea that, you know, all points in space and time are connected. That doesn't really help us understand the data and how psi manifests in real life. And I think that that if you really, really look closely at both the experimental data and especially at kind of the more, real world anecdotal kind of stuff, which I'm not afraid of addressing, psi looks much more like a precognition, but in a very specific way, not seeing the future or knowing the future, but knowing or feeling your own future timeline. Very much like memory, but just like in like a mirror of memory, essentially, a memory for the future.
You provide some good explanations for that, broken down in a way that I think people can wrap their arms around because they're probably familiar with like Dean Radin's precognition experiment, presentiment experiment, but maybe you can go over that or the recent experiment done by Julia Mossbridge from Northwestern, who we had on. So maybe you can do this. Tell folks a little bit about those experiments, what they show, just what the data is, and then create that bridge for people that you're making in terms of what's that, what that's telling you about memory and our connection with our life's timeline.
Yeah. Well, those researchers you mentioned, Dean Radin has done, you know, just monumental work in this field. Julia Mossbridge is doing amazing work. Daryl Bem is the other big name doing this work. And the kind of the term that's often used for their work is presentiment, the idea of feeling the future rather than knowing the future which is the assumption you get from precognition. So right. Presentiment is the idea that we respond often on an unconscious level. Kinds of experiments, they will measure heart rate or galvanic or your skin conductance, and measures of arousal. And instead of showing a stimulus showing a stimulus and then looking at the arousal pattern that happens after a person is shown the stimulus, they will measure the arousal. They'll show the stimulus, and they'll show that there is actually an increase in arousal preceding certain stimuli, you know, emotional stimuli, like erotic stimuli or violent images will be preceded, you know, and different experiments are different. In some cases, it's a few hundred milliseconds. In some cases, it's up to 3 seconds. In Julia Mossbridge's case, she found up to 10 seconds in advance of certain stimuli, some sort of presentiment response. Now, this defies all, you know, linear causal logic. And as a result, you know, skeptics just say, well, that's absurd. And they just don't even, you know, consider that this could be real.
This series of experiments is probably the most replicated experiment we can put Absolutely. Our finger on in right.
psi. It is really robust. This is extremely robust evidence. And it fits it makes a lot of sense. And one of the things that I've been writing about on my blog is that it actually makes sense in terms of what we are learning about quantum physics. And I think, you know, this is sort of my position that we are really on the verge of an actual physical explanation of how this might occur, that this is not as far out as it seems. In quantum physics, they have shown, and this is just in the last, really, literally the last 6 years, that information can be sent backwards in time within a quantum computer setup. And this is not something that requires, you know, curving space-time or whatever. That's sort of the way time travel and information being sent through time has always been thought of before. In a quantum system, you can do it using entanglement of particles. And on the other hand, there's also a lot of people right now looking for precisely such quantum systems in neurons. I think that it's My money really is on that they're going to find sooner or later, you know, maybe in the next few years, maybe it'll be 10, 20 years. They are going to find systems in the brain that you know, like a neuron that could fire before a stimulus. And if you chain, even if you're talking like, you know, a few milliseconds, if you chain, you know, there's 100 billion neurons in the brain. If you chain a bunch of these neurons together, you have a system that would essentially be a pre-sentimental, precognitive circuit. And I really suspect that that's where the answer is going to lie. But there are other explanations out there. Other people have offered different explanations for precognition and presentiment. So, you know, I'm not saying that's necessarily the answer, but I think that with the research from a bunch of different directions, quantum physics, quantum computing, quantum neuroscience, they're all sort of converging on how the future, how we can respond to the future, and how we can also, by the same token, send information into our past.
So even if I agree with you, and I do, that the biological component of this has a lot of room for unexplored territory there in terms of the quantum effects that you're talking about, the entanglement you're talking about, even what you're postulating in terms of how we might know things before we should know them. Aren't we still going to come up short in the grander scheme of things that this biological system that we have, its interaction with what we're now discovering is this fundamental, I don't want to say field, but that's the closest thing we can come to, this field of consciousness, field of awareness, that is but a small aspect to that field. So, you know, I guess you're saying it can be a piece of the puzzle, a piece of the mystery. Or maybe you don't agree with me. I just wonder how big of a piece it could possibly be, given the role of this biological system in the larger picture of how consciousness really rules the world, or rules the universe, if you will, if you get what I mean.
Yeah, I have to say I've evolved on my thinking about what you're talking about, the sort of the larger field of consciousness and the role it would play in all of this. And I honestly don't think that we need to appeal to anything like that to explain psi. I don't think psi is going to turn out to be some sort of deep fundamental question.
Yeah, but you need it to explain out-of-body experience, near-death experience.
Not necessarily. I think the duty of science, and here's where I come back to, you know, really, I guess in the end, I do sort of stand with the scientists, and I say that science is a method of reduction. Okay, you need to reduce in science. It's sort of the essential thing in science is you reduce things to a material explanation and push it as far as you can go. And when you hit a wall, you figure out why things aren't working, and eventually something gives. And that's the history of science. And just because we're at an impasse right now in science on a lot of these questions doesn't mean that science isn't going to progress. I mean, you know, science in 50 years may look nothing like science today. And so I'm kind of more interested in pushing our scientific explanations. I think when you start talking about fields of consciousness, you know, what traction does that have in how can you?
Yeah, but it's all metaphysics at that point. I mean, to suggest that quantum metaphysics is somehow superior to the other metaphysics. I mean, I just break it down into the really simple stuff. So I say, look, and we kind of talked about this before, and we'll just talk about it really briefly. I look at the data, and as I've often said, you know, I've covered 50 shows on near-death experience. I've never had a near-death experience. I don't know anyone who's had a near-death experience. But to me, it cuts to the core. Consciousness stops for these people as best as we can understand it. All our medical understandings of consciousness has ended for these people. They have no brain, or at the very least, a severely compromised brain, incapable of through our medical understanding of producing consciousness. And yet they continue to be consciously aware, enmeshed in the consciousness field, whatever kind of crazy woo-woo term you want to throw. Consciousness persists after death. To me, that's kind of the end of the road for the biological model of consciousness. It shifts everything. We say, okay, we have to look at the biology as being some kind of tuner because the consciousness persists after death. I mean, how do we get around that?
Well, first of all, I'm not addressing the near-death experience stuff. I'm not an expert on that field. I agree with you. There's something really interesting going on there. I don't think it's necessary to appeal to some, to this kind of higher notion of consciousness to explain psi. I would like to be able to explain it in a more reductive way. I don't think that it's going to answer big metaphysical questions about life after death and all that. I think these are two separate issues. The problem with science is when some scientists, because they're so enamored of their very reductive tool and how successful it is, they then say that there's nothing that exists outside of their purview. Okay. That's the problem. That's the problem that I think that you're responding to and a lot of people are responding to. You know, the hardcore materialists who say there's nothing outside of these, we're nothing but, chemicals sloshing around in the skull. Okay. That's wrong, but that's not science. That's scientists who are arrogant. Science itself is it's a very reductive method. It can't pretend to answer these bigger philosophical questions and questions about consciousness and life after death. I mean, those are metaphysical questions. And I'm not one of these people who thinks that science and spirituality need to be playing together in the same sandbox. I think a lot of people nowadays want to bring them together. Well, I think it's good to bring them into dialogue, but science is a very specific thing. It's a method for answering very specific kinds of questions. And as long as you treat it as what it is, I think you don't need to bring sort of larger metaphysical kinds of language into science.
But whenever we say larger metaphysical, I mean, it's all metaphysical. It's like when you say appeal to a model of consciousness. There's no, they're just one model versus another. It's just one paradigm versus another. So it's a completely viable paradigm to say that consciousness is somehow a fundamental element of the universe. That's not less sciencey than to say mind equals brain. I mean, to say that all our tools are engineered to study mind equals brain. Okay, well, that's an engineering issue. Yeah, we have nice fMRI stuff and all these other fancy tools that allow us to study it that way. But to say that, like a lot of very smart people have said, scientific people, that it appears that consciousness is somehow fundamental. It's not appealing to greater metaphysics to say that. It's just saying it's a paradigm shift that we need to make based on the data.
I think you'd find a lot of disagreement about how much data actually supports that idea. I mean, let me tell you, I agree with you. I mean, I think consciousness is super important and it's fundamental, but I don't think we're to a point yet where we can really say how consciousness interacts with physical systems. I mean, quantum physics is sort of where those questions are really posed most pointedly, and there's no agreement in that community about the role of consciousness. I mean, for everyone who points to the necessary role of the conscious observer in measurement and so forth, you have as many physicists saying that that's a misinterpretation of the data. And it's like, I personally, I'm not, as much as I like to dabble in quantum stuff, I am no quantum physicist, and I am not, I'm just not able to, to judge, who's right here. And so I'm just hesitant to say that there needs to be this, what you're saying is that we need to have this paradigm shift where consciousness, is a part of our scheme of things. I mean, I think, I don't know. I'm hesitant to say that. I don't know. I'm not as confident as that as you are.
Fair enough. But I do think you've done a fabulous job of exploring it and kind of advancing this thing. So folks, we're going to move on from this topic because we talk forever about it because I devote a lot of time to it. I think this point you make on presentiment, precognition being somehow deeply linked into the data that we're seeing back from Psy is really an important point. I really think it turns parapsychology into a new direction that needs to be explored more. So you're really to be commended for that. But like I just mentioned, I am going to move on and talk about some other really cool stuff that we may not agree on, but can have a fun dialogue. Tell us about jouissance. Am I saying that right? Mm-hmm. And psychoanalysis. And what are some of your thoughts about what we're missing there that might play into these mysteries that we're trying to understand?
Sure. Well, one of the sort of prevailing ideas, this goes back to the idea of kind of models or sort of old conceptions of psychic phenomena that I think people still have, you know, maintained, but never haven't maybe questioned enough. And one of them goes back to the very beginnings of psychical research to Frederick Myers in the 1880s. You know, he came up with this concept of telepathy. And he really sort of noticed that psychic phenomena of all kinds sort of centered on trauma. Okay. They centered on powerful emotions, particularly painful emotions, crises, you know, death, you know, the sort of phantasms of the living stuff where, you know, mothers would, you know, see apparitions of their sons who were dying on a battlefield far away, that sort of thing.
Teenage girls at a very traumatic upheaval point in their life, right, report this at a much higher rate. Right.
Exactly. So he sort of said, I think, I don't know if he said this, but Jeffrey Kripal sort of summarized his thinking as that trauma was the energy of telepathy, that it was it's what sort of energizes or zaps, you know, phenomena and creates this connection between people. Okay. And so there's this idea, this sort of basic idea that at least tacitly informs a lot of thinking in psychical research and then ESP research in the 20th century, that, you know, psi phenomena are somehow basically this connection between people across space and time, and it's sort of fueled by trauma, okay, fueled by powerful emotions, usually powerful negative emotions, you know, traumatic feelings. I've been lately sort of going back to some of the classic cases in ESP research, for instance, I think that there's something we're missing, there, and that what it could be in a precognitive model is not that we're connecting to other people across space, but we're connecting to ourselves in the future, connecting to our own future moments of learning about traumatic information or traumatic facts. And moreover, that what might be fueling that is not negative emotions, but positive emotions, the positive sort of ambivalent feelings that we have about crises and tragedies that occur to other people. And so I sort of use this in my reading of 9/11, for instance. You know, great big disasters like the Titanic and 9/11 and so forth, you know, they're associated with all kinds of, you know, precognitive, presentimental phenomena, you know, dreams, people have dreams beforehand and or visions of the disaster or whatever. And I looked at, you know, 9/11 and thought about it and thought about, you know, unless you were directly involved, unless you lived in New York or DC and, you know, had loved ones or whatever in the attacks, our feelings when we were, you know, all, you know, riveted to the TV on that day, you know, they were, you know, on the surface, yes, it was trauma. It was horror. It was grief and everything else. Just, you know, terrible feelings. But there was a reason we were drawn to those images, and because that thing drawing us was this excitement that we couldn't acknowledge, you know, publicly. We couldn't say, "I'm excited to see this," but yet people just repeatedly looked at those images, and that's true of any trauma or disaster, and that's sort of basic to trauma and psychoanalysis, that people keep returning to these negative stimuli. Well, Jacques Lacan, the French psychoanalyst, he had this French word jouissance, which fits that perfectly. It's this kind of pleasure and pain feeling, this kind of excitement from really negative, horrific, bad things. It's kind of this almost a masochistic kind of feeling. And I started wondering whether it may not be those positive things, that those positive rewards that we get from big events that might not be the kind of real link in psi phenomena. And it goes back to the, you know, some of the presentiment research done in the lab. The you know, the strongest effects that people experience in these laboratory experiments are to positive rewards, you know, like erotic images or whatever. And I think that there may be some link to our basic reward system, that we are precognitive or presentimental for rewarding future rewards.
And just let me close that loop. But what I heard you say is that the future payoff is somehow the resolution of that trauma in our future life in a way that kind of propels us forward. Did I get that right?
Yeah. So I really sort of am starting to think in terms of these, of our relationship to time as kind of this circuit. We're like completing these circuits, moving through life, sort of orienting towards future rewards. And this, I think, explains a lot. I had a series of blog posts about a year ago now where I sort of took on the Carl Jung's concept of synchronicity using this model. And I think it really explains, you know, so-called meaningful coincidences much better than synchronicity can, because really all it says is that we are orienting constantly, unconsciously, toward, you know, information from our future. We're orienting towards rewards specifically in our future. But when we are completely unconscious of that fact, then when we find this thing that we were unconsciously orienting towards, we feel this surprise and shock, like, and it feels like some intelligence in the universe is guiding us, or you know, like God has sort of given us a sign. But I think it's just really ourselves. We oriented towards this unconsciously, precognitively, and because our society doesn't allow us to even think about the possibility of precognition, you know, we throw up our hands and say, well, it's some bigger organizing force in the universe. It's archetypes, it's collective unconscious, whatever. I think that this psi model of precognition, specifically precognition for our own future rewards, I think this explains synchronicity perfectly. And
this, let me interject, because the one point to take away from that is that part of what you're saying is an unavoidable natural fallout from this presentiment experiments that we have, right? I mean, it's unavoidable, right? That's what the data clearly says. So if you're a student at Northwestern University and you're told you're going to win $5 if you guess the right picture before it's even selected by the computer, and that motivates you, and we can demonstrate that you are therefore able to orient yourself towards the future that's coming, well, then it's only a question of to what extent you're right, not whether you're right or not, because you're clearly right. That's the experiment shows that. It's just to what extent that does play a role in guiding our lives.
That's a great example. Yeah, exactly.
But let's ask the second question. Do we have to go all the way? Because when you do say, and I understand where you're coming from now. I mean, you're saying, here's the field, guys. Now go plant and plow and do everything you have to. And let's cultivate that and see how far we can get down that kind of materialistic explanation that we might get from kind of just doing that grunt work there. Mm-hmm. I do question a little bit about whether we have to throw everything into that and say, okay, well, then that explains God. It explains miracles. It explains signs. It explains angels. It explains everything. I mean, they don't necessarily have to go together. I mean, there can be, as the evidence seems to suggest to me, and I know you don't totally go there, but that there is this almost an infinite complexity to this extended consciousness field. And there does seem to be other entities that reside at other levels that seem to have some influence on our life. In a very general sense, that's what some of the data seems to point back. But I understand what you're saying. What I hear you saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, is, hey, guys, let's just put the blinders on and explore this a little bit, because we're actually getting some useful data here that might propel us forward.
Yeah, that's very well put. That's exactly what I think. And I'm not trying to throw cold water on people's beliefs about a lot of things, you know, but I do think that, you know, this is a very fruitful model to consider. And I'm just suggesting, hey, let's re-look at some of the data and see if this model doesn't maybe explain some of that. A lot of findings, you know, across the field of parapsychology that I think could potentially fall into this model. I mean, one of them just is for instance, is remote viewing. I mean, I'm very interested in the remote viewing literature. It's very compelling stuff. But, you know, there's been this hint from the start, that various people, including remote viewers themselves, have raised this possibility. Well, am I really, you know, viewing something happening at a distance in space, or am I viewing the moment when I'm going to get the confirmation of what is going on at that distant locale in my own future timeline? And, you know, I think this idea is more and more kind of dawning on people, is like, yeah, it may be this kind of precognitive thing. I know, like, for instance, Edwin May, for instance, is arguing this, and I think that you can sort of go back to some of the classic cases in ESP research and kind of, wow, like, turn this around and look at it from a precognition model, and whoa, it's like this whole new story emerges. I mean, for instance, lately I've been going back and studying the classic experiment done in 1937 between this explorer, Sir Hubert Wilkins. You know, he was flying in the Arctic looking for this downed Russian plane for almost 6 months. And he had arranged with this psychic in New York named Harold Sherman to, you know, three times a week, he would send his thoughts about what he'd done during the day to Sherman in New York, and Sherman would record his impressions. And then they sort of exchanged, you know, what had happened. And it looked very much like it was telepathy. But, you know, because there was like remarkable correspondence between Sherman's impressions and what Wilkins was experiencing. And the trouble is, even from the start, it was apparent that it wasn't telepathy really, because Wilkins was too busy to actually like keep his appointments. So he wasn't actually sitting down and beaming his thoughts to Sherman, but Sherman was still recording what was happening to him. And a lot of the time Sherman was recording things that hadn't quite happened to him, you know, like things that would happen, you know, the next day. But they still couldn't break out of this telepathy model, you know. But then later, you know, I guess he was in his 80s at this point, Sherman met Ingo Swann, the great remote viewer, you know, over lunch. And this was at the beginning of the SRI research, Stanford Research Institute, in the early 70s. And Ingo Swann said, well, you know, this, your great thoughts through space experiment. You know, it sounds to me very much like remote viewing, like what we were doing, you know, what they were doing at SRI at that point, which was sending an outbound person somewhere around the Bay Area, and then the psychic back at the lab would describe what they were seeing. And Sherman thought that was great. Yeah, that's totally what we were doing. So if you have this shift from telepathy to this kind of clairvoyance remote viewing model. But what I've been going back and doing is looking through their records, and it becomes really apparent that Sherman was living for those 6 months on this emotional roller coaster that was defined by getting his feedback back from Wilkins in the mail. And I think he was essentially on this, he was almost on what you'd call a reinforcement schedule in conditioning research. He was entrained. He was orienting towards these moments of reward, when he would get his feedback back from Wilkins saying, "Oh my God, you got this right. Oh my God, how did you, you know that I did this?" He would get these rewards periodically in the mail, And his excitement through his narrative is just palpable at this. And the funny thing, yeah, so the idea that emotion fuels this stuff, well, you know, it was his own emotions fueling his own precognition of feedback he was getting from Wilkins. You know, of all people, Wilkins was like the least emotional guy you could ever hope to meet. I mean, he was this stoic explorer, you know, he braved bullets in the fields of Flanders and World War I, you know, filming war footage, you know, bullets bouncing off his chest. He was just this fearless guy who loved, you know, flying planes and submarines and all that, but he had no emotions at all. I mean, he was like, he was really a very, you know, very stoic guy, which he'd have to be. So, I mean, you know, if you're talking about emotions as the fuel for somehow for psychic phenomena, you know, he's not going to be good fuel for psychic phenomena. It was Sherman himself who was reading his own, you know, he was essentially precognizing his own future, you know, and recording it. And the thing is, this is not, does not at all reduce the achievement or negate the efficacy of psi. I mean, or of remote viewing. I mean, it's no less effective and useful, potentially a tool. It's just that how we think of it is different. And I think if we, you know, it could potentially open up all kinds of possibilities for how we manipulate, and utilize these abilities in the future.
Absolutely. I can already think of a dozen experiments that we could do to see whether or not that's really true. Eric, this is all great stuff. Tell folks a little bit more about what you're up to now. Are you working on a book?
Well, I've been sort of kind of on hiatus the last couple months because of some family issues. But I'm continuing to post on the Nightshirt. I am slowly working on a book sort of based on my Nightshirt stuff over the last year and a half on psi. And it's, you know, slow going, and, you know, I have to fit it into my real life. So it's, I don't know when that's going to happen, but so for the time being, yeah, the Nightshirt is where to find my ongoing musings on this stuff.
Well, I certainly hope you find the time, because you're really advancing the field in some really, really fascinating ways. And thanks so much for joining me. My guest has been Eric Wergo of thenightshirt.com.
Thanks. It was great.
Thanks again to Dr. Eric Wergo for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess I'd have one question to tee up from this interview, and it's the question we spent a lot of time on in the show. Are synchronicities, deja vu experiences, and a lot of the psychic remote viewing stuff that gets reported really a case of precognition? And does that mean that science, in particular neuroscience, can make significant headway towards understanding these phenomena? So I think that might generate some interesting discussion. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. You can join me on the forum. More and more people are doing that. You can leave a comment right there on the website. I will do better at following up on those comments. I've kind of lost track of them a little bit. You can also reach me on Facebook or email me directly. The point is, if you want to get to me, you can find me. I'm not hard to reach. And I do hope you do reach out and connect. It's always fun. I will remind you that while you're at the Skeptico website, be sure to check out the more than 300 previous episodes of Skeptico that you can download for free there on the website, or you can subscribe through iTunes or whatever podcatcher suits you. I do have a number of interesting shows coming up, including a look at the NDE Science Cult Connection. That ought to be an interesting show. Do stay with me for all of that. Until next time, take care and bye for now.